WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Official title is Director of Communications,
Oh,
right?
Vice President for Communications.
Vice President, okay.
Yeah, okay. $4 gets you OJ in New York.
Let me just get a copy of your book, which I meant to
bring. All right.
I'll be back in a second.
Yeah, be sure to hold it up so everybody can see it, right?
Okay. Mm-hmm. How would you describe the Moral Majority?
The Moral Majority is a political organization begun by Jerry Falwell and a coalition of 72,000 pastors, priests, and rabbis in June of 1979 to address the erosion of traditional values and moral absolutes in this country, which we believe have led to many of the social problems we now confront. Though we are often characterized by our critics as solely a religious organization and specifically a fundamentalist Christian organization, which is used as a pejorative term by our critics, we are really a religiously pluralistic organization because we consist of not only Christian people of many different denominations and backgrounds, but also conservative Jews, Mormons, and some people who are not particularly religious at all but do agree with our political position.
And your job as Vice President of Communications is?
Well, my job as Vice President of Communications is specifically to write a daily radio commentary, which is on nearly 400 radio stations around the country, to write material for our monthly newspaper, to serve as a major spokesman for the organization, in which I do on college campuses around the country in debates with people such as George McGovern and others, and to appear on radio programs like this so that people will know what we really stand for instead of believing just what they read or hear from others.
One of the phrases that is constantly recurring in your new book, which is called Book Burning, is Christian values. Would you explain what you mean when you use the term Christian values?
Outside of the building in which we are now sitting is a granite wall on which a portion of Jefferson's flaming phrase has been carved. Jefferson said, all men, speaking generically, including women too, of course, all men are created equal and are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, and that among these rights are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, a phrase that every school child learns very early in the schools of this country. A right, in order to be inalienable, must be endowed. Jefferson understood that very well, though he was a deist and though he was a slave owner, and so did not practice the equality that he wrote to our founding documents. Nevertheless, he understood that in order for rights to be inalienable, they had to come out from outside of the institutions of men and women. Any right that is granted by the state, the Congress, the courts, the executive, can be taken away by that same body. What I mean by Christian values, or Judeo-Christian values, as we most often say, are those principles and values found in the Old and New Testament, those inalienable rights, those rights endowed by a Creator. That doesn't mean everybody has to believe in God the way I do, the way you do, the way any of the listeners do. But it does mean that we had better acknowledge that certain rights come from outside of the institutions of men, or we are in serious trouble, open to the survival of the fittest mentality and the manipulation of our fellows who may be stronger than we are. This, of course, was at the heart of the civil rights movement. Martin Luther King and others appealed overtly and covertly to the concept that blacks were equal to whites, not because the pollsters thought so, but because they were made in the same image of God as whites and others were.
You've quoted Jefferson on equality. Do you believe in the Equal Rights Amendment? Should women be equal?
I think you've asked two questions. I certainly believe not that women should be equal. I believe that women are equal to men as fellow human beings, and those who have not gotten around to deciding that for themselves are the ones who are in error. Women do not need my opinion or the opinion of a pollster or even a law to give them equality. They are equal. Now, they do need certain laws to guard against discrimination by those who have not come to that correct judgment yet. Now, I think there's a big difference between saying that and believing that the Equal Rights Amendment is the best avenue to redress some legitimate grievances that women have had in the past. I noticed with interest that Senator Tsongas of Massachusetts, in testifying before Senator Hatch's committee the other day on the reintroduction of the Equal Rights Amendment, could not get down to specifics when he was asked by Senator Hatch, would the Equal Rights Amendment do away with the usual presumption that courts give in child custody cases? Would it do away with the protection women have enjoyed against being drafted for combat? And Tsongas repeated over and over again that the courts will decide that. Well, I don't think that the Founding Fathers had in mind the courts deciding things like that. Those are policy questions left up to the Congress to decide. And one of the problems that we're facing in the country today is that we've become an increasingly litigious society, that everything goes to court. And, of course, the judges are unelected and unaccountable, therefore, to the people. This is not what the Founders had in mind, in my judgment.
Let's be blunt here. Your organization supports the patriarchal family. At
no,
least that's certainly
not
my
true
understanding
all
about
well,
it.
Well, I don't
and
know what you mean by the patriarchal
favor,
family.
If you're in favor of women's rights, what has the moral majority been doing to support equal rights for women?
Well, let's turn it around a second, and it gets back to the old idea of that if you're against busing, for example, to achieve racial balance, you're automatically a bigot or a racist. There are many blacks who are against busing because they don't believe that they want their children going to schools outside of their neighborhood, across town, taking an hour to get there, and not really having any relationship with the teachers because they're so far away. That doesn't mean that blacks are racist. I think there's a proper approach to that, a proper approach to achieving equality that does not include busing. Now, there are plenty of women, many women in this country, who are women biologically, who don't want the Equal Rights Amendment. There is a group of women who have managed to capture the attention of liberal politicians and those in the media, who speak of women's issues as if all women agreed with the Equal Rights Amendment and those that did not were somehow brain transplant donors and are in need of a quick education at Smith or Wellesley College or some other kind of indoctrination. There are many women who don't want it.
But let's get back to the question of if you support equal rights for women, what is the moral majority doing to help women in their struggle for equal rights, which you agreed women don't have, although they should be assured it under our Constitution?
Well, it's like asking non-religious people what they are doing to support equal access and opportunities for religious people. It's all the question almost begs itself. Let me deal with our four basic principles at the moment. People have told us we ought to deal with a lot of other principles, a lot of other moral issues. Perhaps they're right, but we have chosen to limit ourselves to only these four. We are pro-life. We believe all human life is valuable, born and unborn, black and white, so-called handicapped and so-called normal. We are pro-traditional family, the husband-wife, male-female relationship. We don't believe that a homosexual relationship is a legitimate family for purposes of the law, though we would oppose police beating down doors and trying to arrest people who are engaged in private consensual acts. Thirdly, we oppose the illicit drug traffic in the country that has gone to epidemic proportions and the spread of pornography. And fourthly, we favor a strong national defense, not because we believe ultimate security is in missiles, but because we're realists. We lock our doors at night. We don't walk down city streets by ourselves, and we need to take a pragmatic approach to those who are out there to deprive us of our freedoms. And we also support the nation Israel and the Jewish people against those who are anti-Semitic and who would seek to undermine the nation Israel. Now, there are many other issues that are certainly valid issues, and we have gotten involved in the battle against the Equal Rights Amendment because we do not believe that it is in the best interests of stable families. We do support, however, efforts that are currently on the books and other efforts to redress legitimate grievances on unequal pay, on discrimination against women in credit, on the ownership of property, on the rights to sign contracts under their own names, and a number of other on pay and promotion, on equal pay and promotion. We think that many of those things are already written into federal statutes. Those that are not and continue to need to be redressed, we would support legislation to properly address those.
I don't understand fully why you think the Equal Rights Amendment would tear apart the American family.
Well, for the very reasons that Senator Tsongas was unable to answer the questions by Senator Hatch the other day. We're leaving it up to the courts. It's not specific in language. It's a piece of legislation, unlike most other pieces of legislation, designed to be decided by the courts rather than to place into law certain specifics.
If you're so worried about women getting drafted, how come you're not worried about men getting drafted?
Well, the sense of the Congress, as the Supreme Court pointed out a few years ago when former President Carter sought to draft women or allow for the drafting of women, the court said at that time that the sense of the Congress, the people's representatives, in this country anyway, and this is the only one we're dealing with, not Israel, not the Soviet Union, not other nations that may draft women, has been against, by and large, the drafting of women for combat. Now, we think that women should have the right, and do have the right, to volunteer and to serve in any capacity for which their skills and their background and their strength and all other properties qualify them. But to say that women in most cases are not as strong as men physically is not to demean women any more than it is to demean men of saying that you can't have babies. Differences in function does not necessarily connote inferiority or superiority. Men and women should be and are complementary.
Let me reintroduce you. I'm speaking with Cal Thomas, Vice President of Moral Majority. The principles that you just gave of the moral majority are based on what you call the Christian values.
Well, we're talking about the Judeo-Christian value system that was at the heart of the founding of this nation and which did serve it very well up until about 25 years ago.
In most of your writing, like in Book Burning, which I just read, it's Christian values that you really use in writing as opposed to Judeo-Christian
values.
Not
really. I think the principles of the Old Testament, most Orthodox conservative Jews would take relatively the same positions as we do on the issue, for example, of homosexual practice, on the sanctity of human life, that sort of thing.
My question is, you offer yourselves as being representative of Christian or of Judeo-Christian values. The Christian and the Jewish communities are so diverse. There are so many different groups within each of those large headings. How can you presume to speak on behalf of all of them when, for instance, within Christianity, you have peace groups, you have gay groups, you have radical feminist groups, you have lots of groups who have values that I'm sure your group wouldn't agree with, yet they are Christians.
Isn't it interesting that that they are never accused of violating that interesting phrase, separation of church and state? Just as an aside, and then I'll get to the specific of your question, only conservative religious people are asked to knuckle under to this supposed statement in the Constitution, which is not there, separation of church and state.
But they're also not in the schools demanding that the textbooks be changed and that the libraries be changed.
They don't have to because they have been at the source for so many years. Feminists have written textbook guidelines for Random House, Houghton Mifflin, all of the others. The various black activist groups do the same thing. Homosexual groups do the same thing on television as well as textbooks, and that's all presented as academic freedom, pluralism, support of the First Amendment. But when conservatives say, well, now, wait a minute, we're not necessarily interested in banning their viewpoint, but we'd like to have a view because we're taxpayers and citizens of this country, too, then we're dubbed by individuals and groups as intolerant, anti-academic freedom, and so forth. It seems to me to be a double standard here.
Well, let's get back to that.
Okay.
But let's return now to the other question, which is, how can you discuss your values as being representative of Christian values, and how can you offer moral majority as representative of all Christians
when, in fact,
Christianity is so diverse with so many groups?
Right.
Your group would not agree with?
That's a fair question. We are not offering ourselves as spokesmen and women for all Christians, all Jews, or even all conservatives. There are some conservatives, including Senator Goldwater and others, who have spoken out against what we stand for. Senator Goldwater is influenced somewhat by his wife, who's on the board of Planned Parenthood of Arizona, but nevertheless, we are speaking only for a large number of American people who share our values. And I agree with you that there are many peace groups who call them Christians and all of the rest of the list that you enumerated a moment ago. We are speaking where we believe traditional Jews and Christians, conservative ones, have stood in this country, the sanctity of human life and the rest of the things. Now, we're not saying that if you don't agree with us, you're part of an immoral minority. We're not saying if you disagree with us, you're going to political or actual hell. All we're saying is, like Martin Luther, here we stand. This is what we believe in. And we are acting as spokesmen and women for a lot of Americans who have never had a voice before. The people who are parts of the groups you mentioned earlier have had the Berrigan brothers, have had the Catholic bishops, have had the William Sloan Coffins, have had the Father Drinans of the Americans for Democratic Action. Isn't it interesting? Nobody ever says he's violating church-state separation. Have had the Father Healy's of Georgetown University and Father Hesburgh of Notre Dame, who have spoken out on the Vietnam War and civil rights and marched in demonstrations and some of them gone to jail. All within their constitutional freedoms, and we would certainly support their right, indeed duty, to participate in the political process. But our side, our perspective, has really not had very many articulate and vocal persons involved in the political mainstream. As a matter of fact, Jerry Falwell 10 years ago was preaching against doing what he is doing right now. And so it's interesting that even though we're outnumbered by our liberal friends in the clergy and in politics, it keeps coming back to the point that somehow we're doing something un-American while they're doing things in the highest traditions of our nation.
But why do you presume to be speaking on behalf of all Christians? When you're admittedly a sector of Christianity. I mean, how can you use the word Christian values when you know that a large percentage of Christians would disagree with your interpretation of what Christian values are?
I spoke of Judeo-Christian values. We're talking about the traditional values.
Well, a large segment of the Jewish community would violently disagree with
what you're
saying.
Well, I hope not violently, because most of them, I would hope, are nonviolent persons. But
dramatically. Let me change that. My error. Let me change that.
Pacifistically oriented. Well, we believe that historic Judaism, historic Christianity, let me back up and say this. Everybody has a worldview. I think I need to preface the answer by saying this. Everybody has a worldview, and everybody has a religious worldview, whether they acknowledge it to be a religious worldview or not. The secularist who does not go to church or synagogue has a worldview. It is based on one's perception of life, the meaning of life. Who am I? Why am I here? Where am I going? Are the three basic questions of life. Those who believe in a personal, infinite personal God, and who believe certain inalienable rights and responsibilities and values flow from that infinite personal God are going to have an agenda, a political agenda, an educational agenda that flows from that view. Those who do not take that view, say there is no God, eat, drink, and be merry, this is all there is, when we die like the dogs or the plants, cease to exist, they also have a view. Now, the beauty of America is that we're all free, unlike the Soviet Union, where they even lock up announcers who make mistakes about Afghanistan, we are equally free to express our views in a pluralistic society.
What I'm asking you, though, and I'm sorry, but I'll ask again.
Well, I don't mean to be
sliding. Why do you use the word Christian values when we've established that not all Christians, or Judeo-Christian, when not all Jews and Christians would agree with those values? Why don't you say that your group represents a segment of the conservative Christian community or a segment of the fundamentalist Christian community?
Well, I would say that.
And perhaps that would be more clear about who you represent.
I'm talking about traditional. And when I say traditional, what I'm talking about is the view of Judaism and Christianity that preceded the modernist view in this century, which began around the 20s when the seminaries began going liberal. You can't trust what the Bible says, for example, Old or New Testament, the higher criticism crowd in the seminaries. And this group began moving into the forefront. What we're seeing today is really relatively new. Many of the social problems we're seeing today are relatively new. One of the problems in schools, and I understand this is an increasing problem in New York State, is that history now is taught from the contemporary standpoint, and if they have time for going back to the last century, they go back, but they're dealing more with the contemporary scene, and I think it's given students and a lot of adults a very poor historical perspective of our country. So when yes, I would agree with you that we do represent today a conservative Judeo-Christianity value system, and that we do represent one segment of it. However, we would say that we do represent the traditional segment and the traditional position of Jews and Christians on these basic moral points down through the centuries.
Would you ever consider amending the language that you use in print and in public presentations to make it clear that you're representing that segment of
Christianity? Well, I'll tell you, I'll make a deal with our liberal friends. If George McGovern and Senator Tsongas and Ted Kennedy and some others agree that they represent the secular humanist view and one segment of their belief, we'll do the same.
Okay. Cal Thomas is my guest, Vice President of Communications with Moral Majority. Now, you've said that Moral Majority represents the traditional part of the Judeo-Christian community. Mm. Fundamentalism, which is a large part of the following within Moral Majority, is a relatively new part of Christianity.
Not really.
From 1910 with the publication of the Ten Fundamentals.
Yes. Well, that label, you know, they didn't call themselves that. Like a lot of other groups and individuals, that label was, it's like the early Christians didn't call themselves Christians. That was a term applied to them by others, by non-Christians, by many in the Roman community at the time following Christ's resurrection and the establishment of the New Testament church. But fundamentalist was not a word that was coined by the people who wrote that book of which you speak. What it was was an attempt to write down certain fundamentals of the Christian faith, which had always been part of the church, but which were being reduced by the movement toward theological liberalism, of which I spoke earlier, in the seminaries, in the pulpits, and this sort of thing. So a group within the traditional wing of the Christian church at that time felt it was important to write down the fundamentals of the faith. And we can go into those if you want. But unfortunately today, the word fundamentalism has taken on a pejorative nature. You read in the press, anybody who handles snakes or froths at the mouth or runs over children while having a Bible on the front seat or says anything religious that is also idiotic is a fundamentalist. It's a misunderstood term. It is really a positive phrase. It's certainly a positive phrase in football or basketball or any other area of life, but when applied to religious principles, it's applied too often to morons, idiots, and bigots, and that's unfortunate.
Would you consider Moral Majority an evangelizing group?
No, it is definitely not. You won't find in our literature or books or any other material about anything about salvation, the afterlife, or any of that, any religious principles in the sense of what people need to accept or reject in order to go to heaven and this sort of thing. We are strictly dealing with issues. If we got into theology or theological principles, we would be divided immediately. You see, what we've done, which many people don't understand, we've done the very same thing that our liberal friends did so successfully for so long. In 1980, we built a coalition of people from diverse backgrounds, religious backgrounds and other backgrounds, which conservatives have never been able to do before, particularly religious conservatives. A religious conservative would never work with a person of another denomination or another faith before, and so many of our people were often divided, while the liberals would go out and get blue collars, ethnics, Catholics, Jews, blacks, and all kinds of people, not necessarily agreeing on everything that everybody else agreed on, but they said, here is our list of principles and values, this is what we believe in, come join us if you can. And many did. And so conservatives, for the first time in 1980, took a lesson from our liberal friends, and we built a coalition, which is still going strong. And that's what the other side doesn't like. We're beating them at their own game.
Do you think you're winning?
I think we are winning in the sense that we have a stronger case. I don't want to sound arrogant, and I don't want to sound like we're winning because we have better direct mail or more power. I think we're winning now because the American people have before them two agendas. We've had an agenda that was pretty much a part of this country, the strength of the American family, the sanctity of human life, and other things that lasted pretty much up until 1960 with, you know, some exceptions here and there. And then we've had the agenda for the past 23 years that has given us mediocre schools, a herpes and AIDS epidemic, a nearly 50% divorce rate, and many, many other social problems when some of the liberal philosophy has been in control, the open schools, the do-your-own-thing, there is no right and wrong. So I think the American people have two agendas to look at now, and I think they're seeing that while we need to update some of those older values, there's a lot of them that we can bring along and adapt to the contemporary scene.
Was there an official Moral Majority reaction to the bishop's letter against the nuclear bomb?
Yes, I was called, the first reporter who called me and asked for a comment, I said, well, I think they're violating separation of church and state, and got a big laugh from the other side because I wanted to make a philosophical point. I don't, of course. I think that the second draft was certainly much better than the first one. I don't know of anybody outside of a mental institution who is pro-nuclear war, but I would say that all of the pronouncements from the Catholic bishops, Protestant ministers, individual religious persons, and even non-religious persons is really having no effect on the real problem. The real problem is the Soviet Union. It's not the United States that holds Eastern Europe in violation of the agreements at Potsdam and Yalta. It's not the United States that invaded Afghanistan. It's not the United States that is undermining civil liberties in Poland. It's not the United States that's funding revolution in Central America. And although our nation does have its problems and certainly doesn't have a blemish-free record in the area of international affairs, by and large, the United States stands for freedom, freedom of speech, liberty, and justice for all. So I think that the statement of the Catholic bishops, while certainly they had a right, and if they felt so an obligation, and obviously they did, to make a pronouncement on them, is something that is being used against us in the Soviet Union. If they had gone over there to try to make it, they'd find themselves on a train to Siberia.
Getting back to the issue of the bomb and the bishop's stance against the bomb, could you clarify what you thought specifically of an important part of America's religious community taking a stand against the use of nuclear weapons?
Well, I think it's a great stand if we could get the Soviet Union to say the same thing. But the record of the Soviet Union, you know, it'd be like coming out against crime. I think both you and I and everybody in the listening audience, with the exception of perhaps any criminal who's tuned in, would come out against crime. And we'd all get together and we'd issue a statement against crime. Well, that's fine. Now, if we follow that action up by taking our locks off the doors and retiring the police without doing anything about the criminals, we'd be very foolish. And I think that that is what is at the heart of much of the nuclear freeze movement in the United States. We're talking to ourselves. The Soviet leaders aren't listening, and their people certainly aren't hearing about it.
So you feel that there is a religious justification for use of nuclear weapons?
Well, look, I don't want to be caught in that trap. No, I don't think there's a religious justification. I don't think that at all. I'm saying that, as the president did before the National Association of Evangelicals in Orlando a couple of months ago, that there is good and evil in the world. I think most reasonable people would have to agree with that. If Hitler wasn't evil, what was he? In need of a B.F. Skinner modification course? Was Idi Amin evil, or did he need to read a few more books or talk to a psychiatrist? There is good and evil in the world. And I think that you don't need a religious justification for defending yourself against those who wish to, by intimidation or by actual use of conventional or nuclear weapons, deprive you of your freedoms. I think, you know, the Catholic bishops, if they were in the Soviet Union, would not be allowed to make such a statement unless it totally conformed with government policy. There was a small group that was not on the approved list who tried to endorse a nuclear freeze, and they were promptly arrested by the KGB. Religious people, be they Jews or Christians or Pentecostals or whatever, are not allowed to raise their children in a religious home until their kid is 18. If they do, they get their kids taken away by the state. That's not the kind of country we want. It's not the kind of country we fought several wars to make sure it doesn't come about.
So you basically disagree with the bishops?
Well, I agree with their concern. I think certainly this we should not take nuclear weapons or nuclear warfare for granted as a given. I think that Margaret Thatcher was right at the UN Disarmament Conference last summer in New York when she said that nobody ever started a war because they perceived the other guy as being too strong. The way we avoid wars is to be strong. I don't know how it was in your neighborhood growing up, but in my neighborhood we had a bully on my block, and the bully only picked on people who were weaker than he. He never picked on anybody who was as strong or stronger. I think that applies in international relations as well as personal relationships.
Okay, Cal Thomas is my guest, Vice President of Communications for a Moral Majority. You've alluded again to the American tradition of freedom of speech, justice for all. Do you see it as a contradiction to oppose homosexuality and oppose certain civil liberties for homosexuality, yet to support justice for all and freedom of speech? And
well, let's say what it is we really support and what we really oppose. We think that homosexual persons should have the freedom, free of harassment, to practice what they practice in private with another consenting adult. We think there's a big difference between that and coming into the public arena and asking for sanction as a viable alternative lifestyle. We don't believe, in the words of the preamble to the Constitution, that this is it's not providing for the common defense, it's promoting the general welfare. We think, and the reason for that is that homosexuals, in our judgment, and I think the judgment throughout most of history until the recent efforts to rewrite it, has been that homosexual practice, as opposed to orientation, I want to make that distinction, homosexual practice is a chosen lifestyle. What is the evidence for that? The evidence for that is the many millions of people who have come out of it. I've never met a former black. Black persons are legitimate minorities. They did not choose to be born black any more than I chose to be born white. But homosexuals choose to live that lifestyle. And I think the height of ludicrousness now is that the so-called gay community, isn't it interesting that groups are referred to as a community, now want federal funds, tax dollars, to conduct research and find a cure for AIDS. Well, I have a cure for AIDS. Stop doing what's causing it. That'll also cure herpes. It'll also cure unwanted pregnancy. But what we're asking for in America today is not only a right to do what we want to do, but and not only approval to do what we want to do, but also the federal funding for the consequences after we've done what we ought to do. I think that's a mistake.
So you're saying that AIDS is a consequence of homosexuality. If you've engaged in homosexual acts and you've gotten a terminal illness, that's your problem.
Well, I think I think that, you know, it's like saying, what about the promiscuous heterosexual male who is running around and his wife has three or four mistresses and he develops herpes and one of his partners gets it too? Should he have a right to go to the federal government and say, look, I got this herpes because of my behavior and I want you to pay my doctor's bill so I can get cured? No, I don't think so.
Do you think sex outside of marriage should be punishable by disease?
Well, it's not what I think. I mean, the fact is that it is. By and large, not with everybody. I mean,
so you see that as a kind of moral consequence that
you jump off a building, gravity will take over and you'll go splat on the concrete. That's a consequence of defying the law of gravity. I think that there are certain consequences in defying certain moral laws. Some of those consequences lead to venereal disease. Others lead to psychological problems. That's why the psychiatric couches are full of people who have gone out and practiced this lifestyle. It's interesting to me that about every 3 months, Cosmopolitan magazine, which is one of the promoters of the do-your-own-thing lifestyle, carries an article on guilt. It's almost on a regular basis, or at least it was up until last year. I've stopped checking recently. So they're promoting this lifestyle, and then they try to, then they give you an article every 3 or 4 months on how to get rid of your guilt. That's an interesting subject that would make for interesting discussion someday.
So do you think people who engage in sex out of marriage deserve whatever happens to them?
No, I would not be judgmental. All I'm saying is that the person who jumps off a building and defying the law of gravity and perhaps a suicidal act doesn't deserve to go splat on the sidewalk and kill himself. I'm very saddened when people do that, when they're overcome by their problems to the extent that they think their only solution is to commit suicide. But I am saying that there are penalties to pay for violating physical laws and violating natural laws. I didn't establish them. I certainly wouldn't sit down in the moral majority office in Lynchburg, Virginia, and somehow on my Ouija board or some great little power source and say, okay, these are the forms of behavior I don't like, and anybody you engage in them, I'm going to push this button. They'll go blind. They'll get herpes. They'll get AIDS. They'll be short or whatever. I don't have that power. I wouldn't exercise it if I did. I am saying, however, that there are consequences to living these kinds of lifestyles.
So engaging in sex outside of marriage is the equivalent of throwing yourself off a building.
Well, I think it does have consequences. Obviously, there are preventives in various preventatives that can help prevent venereal disease. But I think there are other than physical impairments that result. There are psychological ones, and I think on a broader scope, familial ones as well.
Well, let's get back to the question of homosexuality. Like, what do you think our societal rules should be about homosexuality?
Well, the same as they have been up until the past 10 or 12 years. I think that that people, again, who wish to engage in this form of behavior should be free of police harassment, which they have not always been. At the same time, however, I think in order to promote the general welfare, you know, the family, the male-female relationship wasn't something cooked up by the post office as a convenient way of delivering the mail. This is the family unit was something that was instituted in the Judeo-Christian tradition, instituted by God. It has served the world very well for millennia since the first family. And I think that while granting you know, well, let me say this. We're preoccupied with rights in America. I think Bishop Sheen said a few years ago at the National Prayer Breakfast in Washington that there are no rights given without accompanying responsibilities. Everybody's talking about rights today, but nobody's talking about responsibilities. I think we have a responsibility and an obligation to establish certain norms in our culture.
But let's get specific. Do you support gays' right to equal jobs, to fair housing?
Well, first of all, I don't like the word gay. I think it's been co-opted. It's a perfectly legitimate word. I prefer sodomites or homosexuals. I think it defines the word a lot better. I'm not going to let them co-opt a perfectly legitimate word. Let's call them what they are. I think this is a difficult area. If I'm a landlord and if I have an apartment building and some admittedly openly homosexual persons, obviously you're not going to find out if somebody is not, quote, out of the closet or not. But if some openly avowed homosexual persons wish to rent for me and it's very clear they come with their same-sex friend or whatever, and maybe they even acknowledge it and you know, maybe you have other people in there who will not tolerate that sort of thing, and it becomes an economic threat to you if you allow this particular group in, then all of your other people may move out, then I think that that you have a real problem to consider there. I think this is something that that bears further investigation, but I do think that the landlord has the ultimate right and the ultimate say on who he's going to admit.
What about employment?
I think in the case of school teachers, I would be for a person other than an open and avowed homosexual holding any position. And even in the case of school teachers, as long as they keep it to themselves, and I would say the same for heterosexuals who may be engaged in pre- or extramarital sex, if they don't hold that up to impressionable young people as a valid alternative lifestyle, do their job, and are otherwise qualified, they certainly should be hired.
Yet, for the moral majority, it's really been homosexuals who've been the target. I haven't seen any literature sent out where you say that, you know, promiscuous male heterosexuals are threatening the fabric of our society. And
well,
the
there are no
family.
Promiscuous heterosexual political action committees. I don't know of any group that is trying to push that into our textbooks or establish it as a valid alternative lifestyle through federal or state law, as Dan Bradley and the Gay PACs and some of the others are doing. So we are simply responding to a political activism by this particular community. Yes, if a group came along that said, you know, I believe in bigamy, or I believe in multiple sexual encounters with members of the opposite sex, and we ought to be receive special protection because we were made that way, then we would oppose them too.
They're asking for equal rights under the law, and you're saying no.
I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying that theirs is a chosen lifestyle, and that's what makes them different from every other so-called minority. I certainly would not put them in the same position with blacks, Hispanics, women, who of course are not a minority but have been discriminated against in the past as such.
But they're not asking for the government's permission to sleep with who they please. They're asking for equal rights to housing and job opportunities.
Well, they're asking for a lot more than that. If you read the material, they're just putting it on that basis to make it sound legitimate and acceptable. But the fact is that they don't want to stop at this agenda. I was on the Merv Griffin Show a few weeks ago in California with a woman who is head of something called Parents of Gays, and a man who had recently divorced his wife, moved in with his male lover, and now wants to adopt his two children from the union with his wife into that relationship. And I said, I'm going to read off a list of what I consider to be perverted sexual behavior, and I want you to stop me when I've gone as far as you think we ought to go in the public law. And I read down a list, and I got to bestiality, and I got to incest, and they never stopped me. The point is that the so-called gay community doesn't want any restrictions on sexual behavior of any kind, wants it all taught in the public schools as viable and alternative lifestyles. Any kind of perversion is acceptable. And I'm saying that any culture that has existed in history has not allowed this to happen very long without crumbling from within.
What about the Greeks?
You don't see the Greeks as they were constituted at that time still around today. There was a whole.
No, but they're certainly the culture we always point to with pride as being one of the heights of civilization.
Well, indeed, but we didn't accept everything from them any more than we accepted everything from the Romans, and we certainly didn't accept everything from the British, or we wouldn't have fought a revolution which began in the city.
Let's get to feminism.
Let's get to the book pretty soon, too.
We will. Let's get to feminism. You've said that feminism threatens the fabric of the American family. What's your ideal American family?
Well, this is difficult to define. I know that most of the listeners are going to expect me to say the husband working, the wife staying at home, and 2.3 children or something like that. I don't necessarily believe that that is the ideal family. Jerry Falwell's wife worked in a bank for many years before her first child was born, and then made a voluntary decision on her own, believing that she could invest more and have a greater effect by being a full-time stay-at-home mother to her children than she could going out and building a career. I think the quality of her children, their children, has testified to that. Other people are capable of balancing the two, and that's fine. I wouldn't want to impose my ideal family. I think a family begins, however, when a man legally marries a woman. Now, that might include children. It might not. A divorced person is still part of a family of some sort. A widowed person is a part of a family of some sort, and so on.
So how does feminism threaten that?
Well, I think our feminist friends want to, you know, Betty Friedan's latest writings, notwithstanding, now they're trying to be pro-family since ERA lost, I think they threaten that basic fabric. I think they are. I think it's clear from their writings and their speeches, and Gloria Steinem and many others, that they would not put any kind of definition on what it is that constitutes a family. Just any group, or any two people living together under any arrangement, heterosexual, homosexual, whatever, would constitute a family. And I don't think that most Americans would buy that, our liberal friends' propaganda efforts to the contrary.
Do you think husband and wife should have equal power within a family?
Well, what do you mean by equal power?
Well, equal say over what gets, what the future of that particular family will be, about whether the woman will work or not.
Mine does. My wife and I have been partners since we were married. My wife is also a singer, has been an actress, and is a speaker. And we don't make any major decisions until we talk it over. And see, our kind of relationship is really unusual because I look out for my wife's interests before I look out for my own, and she looks out for mine before she looks out for hers. And so, you know, St. Francis of Assisi talked about in that famous prayer of hers, it's in loving that we are loved. It's in giving that we receive. It's in pardoning that we pardon. And this is what I mean when I said earlier that everybody's out to grab their rights. I have a responsibility to love and to care for my wife in a sacrificial way, putting her interests before mine. She does the same to me. And so in doing that, in sacrificing for the other first and putting the other first, we get everything that we wanted. But the problem is, in too many relationships today, we enter into the relationship and we issue a list of demands. Okay, here's what I want out of you. And the other person says, oh yeah, well, here's what I want out of you. And unless I get it, I'm not giving you anything. And the other person says, well, unless I get what I want, I'm not giving you anything. And pretty soon they're in divorce court. Well, we have a very democratic marriage. I never had a problem with my image changing diapers or putting dishes in the dishwasher. Nobody told me to do it. Nobody showed up to my door and said, this is what you need to do in order to validate yourself as a man. I never had that problem. I guess I was brought up in a strange way. And men who do have that problem, then they do really have a problem. They're not sure of who they are. If not doing certain things for their wives or with them, if not doing certain, quote, domestic, unquote, things, if that's a problem for their masculinity, then they have a problem that they need some help with. I never had that problem. I guess I'm strange.
Most people assume that the moral majority expects women who are wives to stay home, raise children, cook the food. But do you think that moral majority has been misinterpreted?
Well, first of all, I would say that I believe that role for women, should they choose to have it, has been demeaned. I think it has been perceived in the textbooks, in movies, in every area of the media as something demeaning. It's a last resort. If I can't go out and become president of a major corporation, then I guess I can always stay home and have kids. Quite to the contrary, I believe it's the most fulfilling role. Others would disagree, and that's fine, that a woman can have. And I certainly don't think it's a secondary role. I think that my role as a father and as a husband is far more important than what I do as an employed person. Now, I have to be employed in order to make money to exist. But I get far more excitement when my now 10-year-old, just before he goes to bed at night, tells me that he loves me. Now, I can't hang that on my wall with my autographed pictures of presidents I've known, and I can't put it next to all of my reporting awards that I've earned, and I can't, drop that as a name at a party or of some type to impress my friends. But my 10-year-old telling me that he loves me and cares about me and hugging me is much more valuable to me than any of the things that I've achieved in my career.
Well, it's really been the feminist movement that's been in the forefront of trying to get things for women who work at home, like wages for housework, which is interpreted as, say, some social security. So when you've spent your life at home bringing up children in the house, you'll be assured of some kind of finances. Yes. when you're too old to work, or you know, if your husband's deceased.
I'm in favor of assessing the value of the woman who chooses to stay at home and not discriminating against her in terms of pensions or Social Security or that sort of thing. I think that that's a legitimate end of government.
Okay, let's get to the subject of your book. And my guest is Cal Thomas, if you're joining us. He's vice president of Moral Majority. And his new book is called Book Burning. And let me ask you to describe the premise of the book.
The premise of the book is very simply that, yes, there is censorship going on in America today, but most of it is coming from the left and not the right. I do condemn, I do criticize those people who seek to wear the conservative label, who have sought to ban the access to ideas or burn books, and some have done that, and I readily acknowledge that. We have not done it, our organization has not, and we oppose those who do. But the censorship that's coming from the other side, the censorship of traditional values, of morality is not conducted by showing up at somebody's door with a can of gasoline, a book of matches, and a list of books you want burned. Much more subtle than that. I think I may have alluded to it earlier when I talked about various groups, feminist groups, homosexual groups, black activists, and others, who write textbook guidelines and who impose their own worldview on textbooks for school children to read. Now, those views certainly should be carried in the textbooks, but not to the exclusion of the other view. The bestseller lists, another example of discrimination. Many books from the conservative, philosophical, legal, economic, women's issues, religious worldview outsell the so-called bestsellers, and yet they never make the bestseller list. An example, Francis Schaeffer, one of the great living philosopher theologians in the world, has sold 3 million books in the United States alone. Very influential man. Members of Congress, presidents have known him, heard him, been influenced by him. Members of Congress and their wives study his books today. Last May, he outsold Jane Fonda's exercise book 2-1, 300,000 to 150,000. Jane was number one on the New York Times bestseller list. Schaeffer wasn't anywhere to be found on the list or in any review columns. It goes on and on and on. Bookstores relegate conservative books and particularly religious books to the back of the bus, back by the fire exit and the toilet. If the store burns down, if you have to go to the bathroom, you'll see it. Otherwise, forget it. Separate category, separate and not equal. So it's systematic discrimination across the board everywhere you look. Libraries. We're conducting a national survey at the moment. And we have found, after surveying more than 1,000 libraries in every part of the country, that the average library contains fewer than 10% of conservative books. We think that's tokenism. If any other group were involved that way, let's say libraries had only 10% black writers, blacks would quite properly be protesting, or Catholics, or Jewish writers, or whatever. We think it's discrimination. Now, we are having...
What percentage would you like to have of conservative Christian books?
I don't know if a numerical percentage would be proper to arrive at.
Well,
but,
you just mentioned one.
Well,
I know.
I'm just telling you what the survey shows. But, you know, we've got affirmative action programs for blacks who want to be proportionately represented according to their number in a community.
Do you think 10% is a disproportionate view of how many fundamentalist Christians or conservative Christians there are in America?
Well, it's not just conservative Christians. We're talking about books that cut across the board. We're talking about books by Pat Buchanan, a syndicated writer. We're talking about a book by the Surgeon General of the United States, Dr. Everett Koop, who is from Philadelphia.
It
is indeed. We're talking about George Gilder, who is a little more represented because...
Is it hard to find his books?
It is in some cases, yes.
I have no trouble finding it.
Well, you're in Philadelphia, but I've got several here. Here's one in Victoria, Minnesota, a small town, 4 out of 62. Here's one in Brookfield, Missouri, Carnegie Library, 2 out of 62. Here's one from Hunsonville, Michigan, none out of 62. Not one single conservative book in the categories of the women's movement, the pro-life movement, conservative politics, drugs, periodicals, creationism, homosexuality, defense, family policy, politics, philosophy, and the law. These are legitimate subjects of interest and debate today. 3 books in Warsaw, Indiana Public Library out of 62. None in Logan, West Virginia. And on it goes. Some are good. Some have 25 or 30 in the bigger cities. This is discrimination. And this is what my book is about. How to redress that.
You mentioned earlier that you saw Moral Majority as using some of the techniques that you learned from liberals, such as organizing of coalitions.
Yes.
And putting pressure on certain organizations. Is this another example of it, since many groups have accused your group of being pro-censorship? Mm. You're now, in your book burning, saying, oh, it's the liberals. They're the ones who are the censors. We're opposed to censorship, so let's cut it out and make them stop censoring our books.
50 years ago... Goebbels, who was Hitler's chief propagandist, led the Berlin book burnings, the Nazi book burnings in Berlin. They burned Freud and Marx and Lenin and others. Goebbels was also the author of something called the Big Lie Technique, and very basically the way it works and has been perfected to a science by the Soviet Union. This is the way it works. You tell a big enough lie. It has to be a big one. It can't be a small one. Because it can be easily disproved that way. But you tell a big enough lie and you repeat it over and over and over again, and you can get a sizable number of people, particularly if you exclude the competing viewpoint, to believe the lie. It has been said so many times that the moral majority or moral majoritarians, that all-inclusive buzzword, which is a thinly veiled reference to us, are responsible for book burnings and bannings. Anytime anything outrageous happens, as I indicated earlier, it's labeled a moral majority effort. We're not involved in any of that. And I, as I indicated in the answer to your initial question on this subject, I readily acknowledge that some conservatives have sought to restrict access or ban J.D. Salinger or Studs Terkel or other writers who I have read and obviously was not corrupted, or I wouldn't be vice president of Moral Majority. But I think this is the wrong approach. I think the essence of a free society and a pluralistic society is equal opportunity for access to all ideas. And then in a free society, the American people are intelligent enough to make up their own minds after all of the evidence is in, unlike the Soviet Union, which bans authors and ideas and jams the voice of America because it knows that its totalitarian state would not long stand if they allowed competing ideas. We don't want to be like them.
Kyle Thomas is my guest if you're just joining us, and the subject of his new book is what he's discussing, and it's called Book Burning, and it's just been published. Do you feel the media treats you fairly?
I would say on balance, we don't really have a lot of complaints. As long as we're allowed to be on programs such as this, and Jerry Falwell's been on Phil Donahue 11 times, I think by and large we're able to get our views out. I would say that we initially spent our first year and a half to 2 years of existence, we spent most of our time on defense, defending ourselves from charges that were coming from our opponents, which had little, if any, basis in truth. I managed to turn that around, I think, about a year ago when I shared with Jerry and some others that you can't score on defense. You got to have the ball. And so I thought, and since have prevailed in that, that a much better approach would be to say, look, let's acknowledge our shortcomings, those that we've had. Let's ignore the criticism that has no basis. And then let's go on the attack and probe the weak points of the other philosophical side. Because after all, they have the agenda to defend. They've been in power more or less philosophically, if not actually, in the last 25 to 30 years. And let's make them defend their position. And I think that this is meeting with increased success.
So what else can we be expecting to see from your group in the near future?
Well, we're going to form. We said we were reluctant to do this, but we're going to form a political action committee that's going to be separate from Moral Majority. It's going to be called the I Love America Political Action Committee. We're going to begin raising funds, I believe, next month. We hope to raise several million dollars to funnel into the campaigns of conservative candidates around the country, incumbents and challengers who espouse our views. The reason we finally decided to do this is because there were so many liberal organizations, homosexual organizations and many others, feminists, National Organization for Women and many others, who have openly declared their opposition, have developed hit lists against certain candidates. Now, again, we have a hypocritical situation here. When liberals establish hit lists, it's in the highest tradition of America. But when conservatives have hit lists, which we have not had, it's a matter of debate as to whether we will have that next year or not. I hope not. Hope we can still continue to raise the issues and not get into personalities or individuals. But regardless, when conservatives do it, it's intolerant and anti-traditional and all this business.
Are you denying that there were candidates who were targeted for defeat by the conservatives, where huge amounts of money were pumped in to create media campaigns against them?
No, I'm not. But they were not done by us in the 1980 campaign. That was Terry Dolan's NICPAC. That was Christian Voice and others.
Specifically your group.
That's right. Okay. It wasn't ours. And, I think they have the right to do this. The conservatives as well, the liberals, but I don't think they ought to be hypocritical about it, criticizing the right even while the NAACP and NOW and many other groups have openly said they're going to get the president, they're going to get Senator Helms, they're going to get Senator Jepson, they're going to get Senator Armstrong, funneling lots of money into it. And many of their organizations, of course, are federally funded for some of their programs. And then to criticize us for doing the same thing seems to me to be hypocritical.
Jerry Falwell has had a television show for how many years now?
Well, it's been about 26 years. He started out locally in Lynchburg, Virginia, but it was only in the 60s that he really began to expand to a national platform.
You're the vice president for communications. Mm-hmm. How would you evaluate the impact of that program on America?
Well, I'm vice president of Moral Majority. You're speaking of the old-time gospel hour, which is something totally separate, but I do know enough about that to be able to comment on it. I think that the one thing, if I had to say that there's one thing that the press and many commentators have missed about Jerry Falwell, it is this. And that is that Jerry has not established an organization from the top down and sought to go out and conscript members and to educate them about why they ought to believe what he believes. What our friends have missed in the press and elsewhere is that he is simply espousing views and values held by a lot of people who have not had an articulate spokesman before. The liberals have been well represented by many in the clergy, in politics, and many other groups. But Jerry is simply, you remember the movie Network, I'm sure many people do. When the newsman on there urged everybody to go to their windows, to open them up and to lean out and yell as loud as they could, "I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore." That really was the buzzword for a lot of conservatives in 1980. They had sat there, they had allowed every group and what they regarded as some of them perverted groups to have their say, to take over the educational system, to say whatever they wanted from the pulpit, on television, and everything else. And they were told that because of separation of church and state, they had to stay in their little churches and synagogues and not say or do anything. Well, to go along with the movie line, conservatives in 1980 became mad as hell and weren't going to take it anymore. They said, wait a minute, this is our country too. We have a right to speak. We have a right to be represented. We have a right to vote. And so we conducted, and will conduct again in 84, a massive voter registration drive to get our people registered, and then a massive voter turnout, which includes all the high tech with the computers and the phone calling and the voter turnout that our liberal friends have used so successfully for so many years.
Sometimes when I listen to someone from the Moral Majority speak, or when I read one of the brochures or books, mm-hmm. I feel like this is a group that really feels that they're disenfranchised, that they're overlooked by the media, their books aren't represented. Yet every night when I turn on the TV, I can usually find at least one fundamentalist Christian program on the air. Moral Majority has not only the program through Jerry Falwell's all-time gospel hour, but there's radio shows syndicated in how many cities?
Well, it's 450, but all those are paid for. You need to understand the difference. Back before Falwell got on the air on the network.
How many groups or individuals could even dream of paying for 450 radio shows and a national telecast?
You can pay if you have the support. You see, our liberal friends have been puffed up by the left and the media and in academia when they really don't have that kind of support. The liberal seminaries are losing people. The liberal churches are losing people. Their giving is down. If you consider in the Christian tradition baptisms as an indicator of church membership, they're baptized. Are way off. They are declining in number and influence and power. They have these big groups, the National Council of Churches, the World Council of Churches, and many other organizations, but they're hollow. They have lost support. So the reason people like Jerry Falwell and others are able to pay, first of all, they won't be given free time, unlike the liberals were up into the mid-60s. They had all of these programs free on the Sunday ghetto, and the only way the conservatives could get on, they couldn't get any free time, so they said, okay, we'll buy the time. And the networks and the station said, oh, you mean we can make money off of this? And so when the liberals couldn't come up with the money to buy the time, the conservatives bought it.
So how does it work exactly? How do you get the time?
Well, you go to a station and you say we'd like to be on your station, and what is the rate? And if they have a slot, and if you can pay their rate, then you get on. And if you don't have the support, if you don't have the people in that community who send in the money to keep the program on the air, then it doesn't stay on the air. It's the law of supply and demand, like anything else in economics.
What's the most effective technique during the Falwell broadcasts of raising money from the local audiences?
Well, I don't know what the most effective technique is. I haven't really considered that question you asked earlier about what has been the biggest effect of the broadcast, and I want to be careful not to mix Moral Majority with Old Time Gospel Hour, with which I don't have that formal relationship. I would say that a lot of people have found personal help, personal direction, have been instructed and taught on some important issues that they might not have thought about in those particular ways had Jerry Falwell not presented them. And, you know, there's an idea somehow that Falwell is a religious Pavlov who, upon the ringing of his bell, causes millions of Americans to salivate to his political or religious tune. That's just not the case. I think that belief implies a certain bigotry, a certain put-down of a lot of Americans who some people feel can't think for themselves. Many, many of the people who watch and listen to Jerry Falwell have college degrees, are intelligent people, do read, and are very adept at what is going on in the culture. So he doesn't tell people what to think or how to believe or how to vote. He simply expresses their views in ways perhaps that they're not used to expressing.
What some social analysts have said is that the reason why fundamentalism has gotten so much more popular in the past few years is that life has become so complicated and people
I wonder why.
People have real trouble dealing with ambiguity.
Life became complicated because of the unwillingness of a lot of people to accept certain solutions that were basically simple. Not simplistic, but simple. There's a difference. For example, as I mentioned earlier, if you want an absolute, and Ted Koppel asked this on Nightline a few months ago, if you want an absolute ironclad solution to venereal disease, unwanted pregnancy, abortion, and all this other stuff, control yourself. Control yourself. Very simple. Now, things have become complicated because we rejected the simple solution. So that's why things become complicated. And I think we need to go back to first principles here. They became complicated because the simple solutions, which worked so well by and large for this country for so long, have been rejected.
Let me just apply this logic a little bit. If you don't want to get cancer, where can you live now?
If you don't want to get cancer,
which water can you drink? Where can you live, and what job can you work on?
Well, there's a big difference, I think, from I think most people, I hope, will understand the difference between cancer, which nobody gets as a result of an active decision to get it, or cancer is not, with the exception perhaps of smoking, and even in that case, many people who smoke don't get lung cancer. But I think there's a difference between certain physical laws and certain moral laws, and I would want to make that distinction. I don't know where people can live won't get cancer. You know, my father is currently dying of it, and he hasn't smoked for 16 years, and I don't know if that the time he did smoke that he did have it or not, but I don't know.
Do you think there's only certain diseases that we get because we deserve them, so to speak? Because
I don't want to get. I see where you're leading me, and you're a very good questioner.
Yeah.
Look.
Think of all the toxic dumps that people have.
I think you reap what you sow. I think that's certainly a sound biblical admonition, and I think it's true not only in the moral area, but if you sow toxic waste in the love canal, you're going to get pollution. And if you sow effluent in the water streams of America, in the streams of America, you're going to get dead fish and unclean water. And the same applies in the moral area. I think
but the people who sow that aren't necessarily the people who are living on it and suffering from it.
Yes, that's true. And we're talking about, in the case of herpes and AIDS, we're talking about not only a disease that affects the individual now, but increasingly we're told by the Center for Disease Control and other government agencies that it is spreading to people who have not engaged perhaps in the kind of behavior that these others have engaged in to get it. So I think that there is a personal accountability and a personal price to pay for the engagement of this behavior. And then there's also a corporate price to pay. If you want to go back and get religious, in the Psalms we're told that living by God's principles promotes a nation to greatness, but violating God's principles brings a nation to shame. And I think that we have violated those principles in our culture, and I think that is why we are being brought to shame. You know, it was interesting. I read the other day, and I think it was in the New York Times, an American actress was over as part of a touring company in China, and she, along with some others, were touring the Great Wall, the great tourist site, and she had on a sundress, which, exposes some skin. And one of the Chinese translators was heard to remark as in an aside that was understood by an American who spoke Chinese, "The Americans, they have no shame." Now, without getting into whether, you know, the cultural differences and all of that, I thought that was a very interesting verdict on America. We don't have any shame anymore. Nothing is beyond the possibility of our behavior. We're not ashamed about anything anymore. I think that is a shame.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. You're very good.